Welcome to the Blister Podcast, a program dedicated to interesting people, the great outdoors, and a bunch of other stuff we like. I'm Jonathan Ellsworth, the founder of Blister, and you can check us out online at blisterreview.com. Today on the podcast, we try to wrap our heads around Alex Honnold's successful free solo this past Saturday morning of the free rider route on Yosemite's El Capitan. I'm joined by our climbing editor, Dave Alley, to talk about the feat and to try to put it into perspective and historical context. And just in case you aren't clear about the magnitude of Honnold's achievement, we are going to raise the question of whether Alex's free solo of El Cap is the greatest athletic achievement ever. Because that is legitimately in play, and if you are skeptical of that, you should definitely listen to this conversation. Dave also breaks down for us some of the more specific details of Alex's route on the wall that you may not be familiar with, and then he and I dissect this accomplishment, try to locate it in the history of climbing, and contextualize it within the broader world of athletic achievements. Like many others out there, Dave and I are still attempting to wrap our minds around this climb, and that is one of the clear signals why this is such a monumental feat. We know it happened, and it's still really difficult to believe. Also, in the show notes to this podcast episode on the website, we've included links to an interview that Honnold gave shortly after his climb. There is also an incredible piece by Honnold's good friend and frequent climbing partner, Tommy Caldwell, about Honnold's attempt. We also have a brief video of Alex on the wall, and there is a link to a phenomenal photo gallery that was shot from the El Cap Meadow. All of these pieces are not to be missed, so be sure to check out the episode show notes on the site. And on that note, let's get back to my conversation with Dave Alley about Honnold's climb.
We recording?
We are.
Cool.
Your first time on the podcast.
That's right.
How on earth has it taken us this long? It took Alex Honnold doing the impossible to get you on this podcast.
You should have contacted my agent ages ago, man.
I know.
I'm a busy guy.
Yeah, I know. Okay, well let's do this. Let's go to a little bit of a backstory. It was this past Saturday, and I believe I had just finished or was still reviewing skis up in Colorado when I get a text message from you saying, let's see, and I quote, "Honnold soloed free rider this morning, becoming the first person to solo an El Cap route. Mind fully blown."
Yeah, and that about does it.
And that is exactly what happened. I think you sent the text early, but I didn't get it till I actually got off the mountain. And I was driving, and I almost drove the car off the road.
I think it says like more than the actual anything that you could say in a text. The fact that I felt compelled to text about climbing basically tells you all you need to know.
Yeah.
I mean, people climb things and the world doesn't care, you know? Like, I don't need to text my non-climbing friends about it, usually.
Yeah. No. So that is the backstory here. And then you and I have been kind of going back and forth a bit. And finally, I was just like, I mean, I haven't really stopped thinking about it since I got the news. And so here we are, and we just wanted today to kind of like go over and try to process this thing that actually kind of is rather mind blowing. So let's
so
get
much to unpack. That's the thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I've spent so much time over the last few days thinking about it, and you know, there's just so many angles and so many things that make this unique, and it's so easy oftentimes to understand things, you know, by way of some comparison to other things, but this is like just very slippery in that regard.
Yeah. So Dave, what, I mean, let's just real simply, what did Alex Honnold just do on Saturday?
Yeah. So that's a super good question. He, the short is that he free soloed a route on El Cap called Free Rider. And, essentially what that means is he climbed the rope with just shoes and a chalk bag, you know, or I'm sorry, route rather, with just shoes and a chalk bag, no rope, no harness, and stuff like that. And this really gets garbled sometimes in non-climbing media, because free climbing is what most climbers do when you are using a rope, right? And you're just kind of ascending the rock using your hands and feet, but the rope is there to catch you in case you fall. And so that's a little bit of a tragic name for that, because it's, I think in the modern world, we think of free climbing at, most people hear free climbing and they think free soloing, which is what Alex Honnold did. In reality, free climbing came about initially because most climbing was done as aid climbing. And then, you know, free climbing is sort of a more recent arrival in the scene, but.
Wait, say just a quick word. It really is a stupid name. We really need to ditch free climbing.
I know. So essentially like aid climbing.
Yeah.
Aid
talk climbing about, back talk in the about, day. Yeah, that's what I want you. So I think we're clear, right? I mean, free soloing is no ropes. You just, your shoes and a bag of chalk. Free right. climbing is what we would call sport climbing or rope climbing now. So aid climbing, I think
aid
that's
climbing
when
is essentially where you are, you're using the rope systems directly to ascend the route. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times, and this is how most parties climb big walls like El Cap. It's at one point or another, if not for most of the route, you'll clip a ladder, some sort of fabric ladder into a piece of gear or a bolt or what have you, and then stand in the ladder, climb the ladder, and so forth. And so you're ascending the equipment, right, up the wall rather than using your hands and your feet to ascend the wall itself, which is sort of how most people know climbing, right? That's how you do it in the gym. And in that scenario, the rope is still there, but it's really only there as your backup plan. You know, if you fall, the rope will catch you, but you're not pulling on the rope. You're not like pulling on the draws and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. At least that's not your like express strategy when you leave the ground. Right. You know, like I'm going to get on this super hard sport route and just pull on the draws all the way to the top.
That's actually what I call climbing.
Yes.
That's what I do. Exactly. Yeah.
The rest of us non-pros pretty much do that all the time, but
right. I just call it Ellsworthing.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Let's hashtag that and get it going.
Exactly.
I think so essentially, you know, the free, this all started, this confusion, the free climbing quote unquote revolution was something that happened in Yosemite and elsewhere, you know, many, many decades ago, probably the 70s and the 80s. And that was meant to be that you know, they had shown up with enough skill and athleticism and so forth to climb, to like actually climb the routes themselves and not just hammer in pitons all the way up this crack. Yeah. And so that I think was, they talked about that as like freeing the route from, from the use of direct aid. And so back in the day, there was really just aid climbing. And then there's this like newfangled thing called free climbing. Like, you know, there's not really much opportunity for confusion there. The problem is that when people start doing this stuff alone, you can climb big walls with ropes by yourself, and that's called rope soloing. You're there with a rope, you're doing it alone. And then the sort of most extreme version of this is free solo climbing, where you are free climbing the route, which is to say climbing the route itself, not using the gear to ascend, but you're also doing it alone, so you're doing it without the backup protection. So free solo climbing is really, it's very, very different than all the essentially everything else that we talked about.
Yep.
Free solo climbing, Alex Honnold did not invent this. You know, this has been going on for ages and ages, and there are super high profile free solo climbers in Yosemite for decades, like John Backer and Peter Croft, and most recently people like Dean Potter. And a lot of really, really hard, super impressive routes have been free soloed. And, you know, if you want to view it through that lens, you could totally make the case that this is this obvious progression and blah, 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 blah. But it's really, you know, because of the danger involved, I think it's hard for people to see that linearity, as it is with like many other sports, you know, like with running the fastest mile and so forth. It's just that seems to me like, here's a better example. You know how Nike and a bunch of other companies are in this big push to like break the 2-hour marathon?
Yeah.
So that they're pouring like all the research and the money and stuff into that. And honestly, that feels a little bit to me like you're just going to play a waiting game until a person with the right physiology comes along who's been able to work with a trainer since birth, you know? And, but there's not necessarily like hugely more to it than that. You know, you have a motivated individual with the requisite support and, you know, the backing of modern science, and then eventually you will get there. Presumably, maybe not. Maybe we realize there's some hard physiological stop at 2 minutes or 2 hours and 1 minute or whatever, but, you know, I don't know, but with the certainty of death that comes along with free soloing, I feel like it's hard to really make the comparison, because the impressiveness with free solo climbing rests oftentimes like not on the route itself or the technical difficulty of the route itself. It's like the statement of mastery that's being made.
Yep.
And that's very different, I think, than just saying like, okay, once you hit this dead flat sprint, how fast are you going, or how long can you sustain it, or what have you? You know, those are very much not. I don't want to say that they're not psychologically challenging, but it's not fair to compare the two psychological challenges.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's kind of bracket that. Like, I want to get to that a bit later. I mean, that's a huge component of what I want to talk about, right? But
yeah, totally.
But I want to stick on the kind of particulars of like this, like what did Alex just do?
Sure. Okay. LCAP is known for being, home to one of the largest concentrations of these like massive big walls, like what are called like grade five, grade six routes, right? Which is sort of a determination of the amount of time it takes average competent parties to climb the route. And I mean, just for the record, I would say that, you know, the average team that climbs the Freerider or the South A wall, which shares a lot of terrain with Freerider, mm-hmm. is probably like 3 days for Freerider and four for the South A.
Average and, climbing group will take 3 days to
climb this route.
The Freerider route. Okay.
Yeah. To be honest, most people, I guess people do a Freerider frequently, but, some of that gets into the whole speed thing that you were talking about a minute ago. So, you know, we'll put a pin in that and come back. But, you know, these routes are massive, right? I think this is a probably 3,300 or so foot route. It involves a huge amount of down climbing, low on the route, which is, you know, obviously its own challenge and so forth. But, this is the first time that a quote unquote LCAP route has been free soloed. And the reason I, make that distinction is there is a route called the west face of LCAP, which is significantly shorter than this. It's just sort of like if you follow the west face of LCAP, like around Looker's Left, then you kind of walk up the hill. The routes get a little bit shorter as you're able to ascend the hillside before starting the climb. And there's this long multi-pitch, you know, in the teens of pitches, I would say, maybe like 15 to 18 pitches, depending on how you do it, 11C free route that's called the west face. And I think he free soloed that kind of a while ago, but that's a very different experience, even though it's on the same feature, right? And so this is the first time that one of the like capital B big walls has been free soloed on LCAP. You know, prior to this, he had done repeated a bunch of the famous free solos in the valley that had been done by people like Peter Croft or Dean Potter, like Astroman, the Rostrum, and then most famously he free soloed Half Dome via the regular Northwest face, which I think, you know, he had been maybe prominent on the climbing scene from earlier free solos, but that was the first time that I think he became like a national figure and, you know, was on like 60 Minutes and all that stuff, just because that was, you know, not, that was Half Dome, right? It wasn't some obscure desert route that climbers geek out over, but nobody else knows. It's outrageous in part because of its scale and its difficulty, and all the challenges that come with those things. But, it's just so, you know, it follows in the tradition of all of the other times in climbing history where something like this has been done, where there's been a robust debate about like, is this a humanly possible thing?
Right.
Yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And then somebody just goes and does it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why it's so, so mind blowing.
I think another, like, to put it in like really, really simple terms, like this route, if you just had a picture of LCAP and you told someone, draw a line from the highest point of El Capitan down to the ground, Mm-hmm. I mean, that's free rider. I mean, it's not a straight line, right? But like, it's not one of the longest routes
in the valley. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't know. Like, literally, I mean, if it's not the exact summit point of El Cap, I mean, like, it is right there at like the highest point on that wall.
Absolutely.
Which, like, if I had to free solo El Cap, I'd be like. Like, how do I cheat this over to I mean, I'd be dead 80 feet off the ground, so it wouldn't really matter, but there really just is, like, talk about an exclamation point. I mean, it's
totally true. And, you know, that not a ton of route is a ton of terrain rather is added to the route by the fact that you have to do all of this down climbing. So free rider historically is a fairly recent route. Okay. So the FAA was done in, I think, like 1995, by one of the Huber brothers, Alex Huber, who was like a, you know, he and his brother, Tomas Huber, these two European guys were big, you know, climbers in the European scene, mostly sport climbers, came to the Valley, took up crack climbing and, you know, made a big impact on, you know, American climbing in Yosemite and so forth. And so free rider was established as a free climbing variation to the Salathe wall, which is like the second route put up on El Cap by Roy Robbins way back in the day. And the Salathe for itself is a super classic aid wall. It's amazing. That direct wall goes free at like mid 513 and is supposed to be super classic as a free route. Free rider takes that ascent, that general template, and does a bunch of variations to avoid some of the harder free climbing that's on the Salathe wall, if that makes sense. But for the most part, those routes follow a similar trajectory. And both of them start out with the first 10 pitches are usually often done just by themselves as a route called free blast. And so you climb these first 10 pitches and you get up to this big, big, you know, I guess like standing buttress pillar thing called Mammoth Terraces. From there, you have to do this massive rappel down to Heart Ledges. And so you have to lose like 190, 200 feet to get down to Heart Ledges, which for Honnold is like a 10D down climb. You know, you're not just rappelling that. And then later in the route, there's another pitch called the Hollow Flake, where most climbers do this what's called a pendulum, where you lower down on your rope for however many feet and you start running back and forth across the wall until you can swing all the way over to the left side and get yourself stuck into this little flake thing, this big obelisk. But that's, you know, because he doesn't have a rope, can't rappel down and do this pendulum, that's an 11D down climb, you know. And that's all terrain that you have to make back up, right? Because you just climbed all the way up to get there and then you're climbing 200 feet back down and so forth. And so It's not even like if you were to just do that whole straight line thing that you were just talking about, like even that would be shorter, you know, because the route goes up, down, up, down, up, down.
Yeah.
And that's just incredible. And as impressive as that is, I think that does get at something kind of interesting, which is that like free solo climbing is, like it's hard to answer what is like, what makes a route an impressive free solo, right? Is it the grade or is it the grade and a whole bunch of other things? Is it the length of the route? You know, there are certainly routes that are maybe like have harder cruxes, but are easier or more appealing free solo candidates, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Free rider is a perfect example. So the crux pitch comes like 22, 23 pitches up. And the traditional route, free rider goes at 12D, and this crux 12D pitch is called the Teflon corner, where there's really no holds, and you're doing this like 90 degree stemming, right? And it's supposed to be just absurdly insecure, and the granite's really slick, and a lot of climbers have said that, you know, you work it and you work it, but you can still like grease a foot off at any moment, like unexpectedly, right? And so most people who aspire to climb the route, and this is exactly what Alex Honnold did, do a variation to get around that pitch called the boulder problem. And the variation goes at 513A, which is by the numbers harder than the stemming corner, yeah. but it's this 513A. It's like this V7 boulder problem, which is hard as fuck, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's more like climbers would say that that's more secure, if that yep. makes sense. Like the holds are ultra tiny, but if you're super strong and you grab them right, you know you have them right, and so you know you're good. Whereas, a lot of times if you're just doing this like super desperate friction climbing, it's harder to really know what you're on.
Yep.
And so, yeah. Anyway. That's like, I think that's one of those things that makes it hard to unravel these things or even compare them to other routes or other solos, because there's so much that goes into making a route like an easy or difficult free solo, where, you know, it's easier to just talk about, hey, how hard is this route compared right. to like, how hard is that route? Like, yep. That's a little bit more of an approachable conversation.
Can you imagine doing a V7 boulder problem? I mean, where are you? Where are you on the wall?
I think you're probably 23 pitches up.
Oh my God.
So yeah.
I mean, it's basically like bolting climbing holds on an airplane.
Yes. And then... Oh my God. Totally. Yeah. It's horrific. It's like, I can't even imagine. I mean, I don't even think that I would be psychologically fit to be a cameraman for an event like this.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine like trying. I don't even like, I hate free soloing, like even easy stuff. You know, I cannot imagine climbing a V7 with any consequence ever.
Yeah.
That's, oh my God, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah. So that was actually a really helpful description. Talking about, you know, avoiding the stemming section, instead right. opting for a V7, 23 pitches
insecure
up.
V7 boulder problem. Yeah.
You know, the down climbing a 10D.
Yeah. And then an 11D, you know,
my God.
I mean, no, thank you.
No, thanks.
Yep, exactly.
I think we got to talk about the speed component of this,
sure.
which like is like this afterthought. I mean, yeah. You know, granted, this just happened Saturday. And I think people are like us, I think, are just trying to process this and locate it within the history of climbing. And frankly, what we're going to talk about is in the history of like athletic achievements and like broadly written outside of climbing, far outside of climbing. Mm-hmm. But the speed component of this, I mean, you just said that an average group might ascend free rider. A group might ascend free rider with ropes in 3 days, I believe you said.
Yeah. Yep.
And he did it in 3 hours and 56 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I did, a buddy of mine and I climbed El Cap in the fall, and it took us 3 days. And, you know, it's not like I spent 2 days and 20 hours just like sitting around, you know, and then like the end, we were like, all right, let's roll. It's time to get to the top.
Yeah. We got to stop watching YouTube videos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think I'm really glad you brought that up actually. And I think that's an interesting point. Part of it, this is going to be odd, but that's one of the less impressive aspects as a standalone point, only because the reason he's so fast is because he's soloing. It's not independent of his solo. Like he's also doing it quickly. So when you don't stop to belay, that frees up so much of your time.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's say when he and Tommy Caldwell race up, they did this route last week, I think in one of his like prep sessions, and they did it in like 5 hours or something, which is insane.
Okay. 5 hours.
And that is blisteringly fast for a rope team. You know, they probably simul-climbed huge amounts of the route and all that kind of stuff. But let's say just for the, you know, to bring this down to like a, you know, a simplistic level, let's say you're doing a standard multi-pitch route the way that most climbers experience climbing, where one person climbs, the leader goes up, belays the second up, and then they continue on in that fashion up the wall. So each climber, if you forget, let's say they have this very fast change over the belays and all that stuff, each climber is only really climbing for half the time, right? And so let's say hypothetically you're to go back and free solo that route without a partner. Well, then you're probably, without changing anything, you're probably going to do it in half the time or less that it took you to.
Yeah.
And so you would expect him to set a speed record anytime he free solos a hard route like this, just because he never stops. It's not that he's necessarily moving quickly at any point. Like certainly speed free soloing seems like down on one knee begging for death, right? Like that is just, that is sprinkling the element of competition in the wrong place for sure.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think that's really what it is. I think that's a feature that's inherent to the free solo style of climbing. Like a couple of years ago, I think he climbed Mount Watkins, El Cap, and Half Dome in a day. He did all of them alone. He brought a rope and rope soloed the harder sections, and then would put the rope away and free solo the easier terrain. Mm-hmm. And I think he set the speed record on Mount Watkins easily because, you know, I don't know that anybody had ever gone and done that when they, you know, free soloing that much of the terrain and that kind of thing. So, it's almost, certainly not to imply that he's like cheating by doing that.
Right. Right.
But it's not fair to, necessarily like, you know, compare that to the 5 hours that it took him and Tommy to do it, which is like almost equally impressive for like the doubles.
Yep.
You know,
the only thing I'm going to say is like, have you ever seen, right? Like, there are some of these, I don't know, I've seen it a couple times, but where you have these like NASCAR races or whatever, right? Where like they're trying to put just enough fuel in the cars.
Yes.
To finish. And then sometimes they like just run out of gas, like right before the finish line.
Yeah,
think about that in terms of free soloing, right? Like, so you're like, no, dude, the speed's not that impressive because he doesn't have to get ropes. I'm thinking about the fact that at 2,800 feet off the ground, if you pump out, you're dead.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And so in terms of thinking about how dialed in, just another element of you really like, maybe I should have rested 5 more minutes before starting this pitch.
Yeah.
Just another level of like, I mean, that's just something, I mean, I've actually not really heard Alex or anybody else talk about that. But thinking about like, when am I ready to start this pitch? Cause literally like you pump out or like you get hung up. I mean, dude, you've been on routes that you've done a bunch of times. And then for some reason that day you missed a hold or something. And then you're like fidgeting around longer than you should have. And you start to get worked. That happens. You're dead.
Absolutely. And so, you know, that's a big part of it, right? Is that, you know, that gets at that whole demonstration of mastery thing.
Yeah.
And so part of why you can look at Alex Honnold and talk about how he's such a good climber. I mean, if you were to just, let's say you knew nothing about this guy.
Right.
And you were like, oh, somebody told you, hey, this dude just soloed free rider. And, you know, I think if you didn't think about it at all, you might be like, oh, this dude just did a 12D or 13A. This guy just sent 13A. People send 13A all the time. People on site 13A, you know. The top sport climbers in the world, like Alex Magos or Adam Ondra, have each flashed 14D, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're saying like, well, yeah, this guy just climbed 13A, so what? But it's more, the statement isn't like, oh, I just climbed 13A. The statement is, I am so comfortable on this terrain that I will not pump out in it because I can rest like for almost the whole way. You know, it's like if you and I were to go do a 5.5 or 5.6 or something, you're probably not going to pump out because whenever you find yourself getting tired, you can just like shake out, right? Mm-hmm. Not so if you're on terrain that's close to your limit, but you know, you obviously have to be so far below your limit in order to free solo that you're like, well, you know, this, I'm not scared free soloing this pitch because, you know, I can just like stop and recover and get it back or not get pumped in the first place really is the thing. Like ideally, if you're getting pumped without a rope, you're in big, big trouble.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's such a large part of it. And I think, you know, the other thing is that there's a big appeal to routes that involve mostly for the most part, crack climbing, you know, mm-hmm. I guess the crux on this was a face climbing boulder problem and so forth. But, you know, if you are cracks just tend to feel, I think for a lot of climbers, once you've sort of climbed in that style for a while, they tend to feel more secure.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to break a hold off. You know, mm-hmm. you're not, bearing down on your fingertips. You know, if you're swimming like in perfect hand crack, most climbers would tell you that they feel really comfortable. Like the chances of them falling are near zero.
Yeah.
And As you get better and better, right? You could just feel that way on all kinds of crack sizes.
Right. And sorry, is it 33 pitches on free rider?
Yeah. Yep.
So how many of those are like the pitch is basically 100% crack?
That's a really good question. I mean, I have not done free rider. I would say that most of them are probably at least predominantly crack climbing. I know there's a bunch of slabbing on free blast. Mm-hmm. And then there's the boulder problem, which is face climbing. But I don't know actually without having done the route. And I mean, I guess I could pour over the topo, but it's hard to say that they'd be 100%. I'd say that almost the entire route is crack climbing.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember, you and I both read, there's this amazing interview that everybody should go read.
Yes.
Right? Like right after Honnold, or shortly after Honnold gets off this send. And I believe there does he mention, it's free blast that when asked like, what was the trickiest or toughest section? I may be making this up. I'll have to check, but, I wondered if, I mean, in effect, like, so the answer, what was the trickiest section? Sounds like it may have been one of the non-crack pitches,
yeah,
which would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you, with things like, with climbing cracks, you know, you get so much more feedback from the rock, if that makes sense, like sensory feedback, right? Your finger, like if you're climbing a finger crack, right? You're looking at it and you're like, my fingers are all the way in this crack, or they're, I have whatever it is kind of lock. You can assess the quality of your hold much more easily. Whereas with slab climbing, you know, there is some sensitivity transmitted through the soles of your shoes and so forth, but you really are relying on inference from your previous experiences. Like this will hold because it sort of has in the past, or, you know, I've done a lot of climbing on slab. I sort of intuitively know how the movement works and so forth, but it's just not quite, you know, you put your foot on a hold and you're sort of left to infer, you know, maybe quite confidently, but it's not quite the immediacy of a crack where you're like, well, my whole fucking hand is in here. So, you know, there's no way it's coming back out.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about locating this free solo of El Cap among, like, some other climbing feats, like, for the sense of, like, perspective, right? I mean, we're in a culture, something happens, and it's, like, you know, the greatest thing ever, right? So,
yes.
The Golden State Warriors are currently the greatest basketball team of all time, which, actually, maybe they are. But we call it a recency bias, right? And so if it just happened, it's the greatest thing ever. And so I think this is an incredibly tempting case to be like, yeah, this is the greatest thing ever. But so like, let's just back up for a second, talk about a couple of relevant sort of staggering feats, right? And the one I kind of first thought of was really was Lynn Hill's first descent of the nose.
Yeah, on free ascent.
Free ascent. Big,
yeah.
Sorry.
So yeah. No, it's cool. That's probably the example. You know, I think that's exactly spot on. You know, she came along and looked at this route, and the challenge for her and everybody else at that time was believing that was within the realm of athletic possibility, like that could be done.
Meaning climbed with a rope, like sport climbing. Sorry for dumbing it down, but effectively people used to think it's probably not even possible to sport climb, in effect, the nose. So this was, had previously only been done aid climbing.
Right. And so the way that a lot of these routes work is, let's say you are, you're going to climb the nose, right? And so the nose is, if you're an elite level climber and now you're going to, let's say you want to repeat Lynn Hill's feat of freeing the nose. Okay. There's probably like a dozen or so people who have done this ever, which is impressive, right? That's ridiculously impressive feat on her part. First of all, to come along and do something that nobody else really thought that it was going to do, but it didn't see a repeat until like 10 years later. Right. And it's not because like nobody wanted to climb the nose, you know?
Yeah.
It was just that impressive. And so let's say you and I are going to go and we're going to try to do that. Well, you know, we're, you know, hard 13, mid 14 granite climbers, that kind of thing. Then if that's the case, almost the entirety of that route is going to feel really easy to you and I, and we're not even going to really have to train for it, right? There's tons of pitches of 5.8, 5.9, 5.11, all that kind of thing. And that'll just be super cruiser. And so that's really the major part of this, is that not the routes are not sustained in difficulty all the time. Mm-hmm. And so if you really try to attack them, what you do is you break them down into these pitches where you're like, okay, all in the example of the nose, essentially all but two of the pitches, there's the Great Roof pitch, which is 13C, and then there's the Changing Corners, which is the 14A crux of the route. And so if you have a legitimate chance of free climbing the nose with ropes and all that stuff,
yep,
then you really only probably need to put serious time into those two pitches, mm-hmm, you know? And so that kind of mentally frames the route in a very different way, right? Because you're like, well, I just got to figure out these two pitches. One's 13C, one's 14A. You know, that's a reasonable goal. And then if you can unlock those two pitches, then you can just start from the ground and do the whole route.
Yep.
And so that's, you know, that's a, I think, critical in terms of, you know, how do you set yourself up for success on these massive projects, right? You do a great job breaking it down into small achievable goals. And part of the reason why the nose has not been freed more frequently is that working those pitches is extremely difficult because they're 2,500 feet off the ground, right? It's not like you just stroll up to the cliff and practice them. You have to hike up at the top, rappel many pitches down to get to the pitch with, you know, work the pitch, blah, 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 blah. It's a huge pain. And so nobody really does it, but that's like, I think it's a much different psychological challenge if you're thinking of this as two pitches as opposed to like 30.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's, I imagine how Alex Honnold goes through and approaches a route like this, right? He's kind of like, okay, gets this idea in his head. Well, all these pitches, I think I can probably do straight out of the gate. Well, where are the ones that I'm going to have to work to feel super secure on, right? There's the boulder problem, there's this corner, there's that down climb, and so forth. And then slowly, each of you kind of figure out the moves and practice them, and you start to feel secure. And then the problem, quote unquote, problem pitches for you sort of dwindle until you feel like you have the whole route. Mm-hmm. And the thing about something like Lynn Hill's climb, it's certainly true that she took that achievement out of the realm of impossible and put it squarely on the front page of newspapers and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that I think that that is in any sport, anytime somebody does that, where they run up against that kind of people saying this cannot be done, mm-hmm, it's super impressive because, you know, in order to get up and say, I'm going to go work this pitch for the 40th time to try to figure it out, and I'm going to put forth like all this energy, you're doing so in the face of people who are saying you're wasting your time because nobody's going to be able to do this ever.
Yeah.
Right. But you have to hear that and say you're wrong and I'm going to be the first to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's like, that's, I think there's really something there that separates elite athletes from most of us. And so certainly, you know, her achievement shares that genius with this free solo. And then, you know, in that same vein, just the very first ascents of these routes, you know, Half Dome and then El Cap and stuff like that, when those, that went up, you know, in the 60s and so forth, people were like, no, those walls are too big. You're just not going to be able to do this. And so eventually people found a way and they did it. And, you know, obviously that's how these things sort of progress. But you know, there's something to Lynn Hill's freeing of the nose that is, it's just a little, I personally find it easier to imagine myself in the state of mind of believing in the possible.
Yeah.
When what happens, you're basically allowing yourself to go out and try at something at your physical limit as literally as many times as you have to get it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're saying for her, crossing the finish line meant sending this pitch, doing this route on the 10th try, on the 5,000th try, like whatever, right? Like the goal was to get the send. And that's a very different finish line than with free soloing a route that you anticipate being really challenging or pushing a boundary for you in some way, because the finish line is like, oh, I can't just try this as many times as I have to. I need to prepare enough that I can guarantee that I will get it on my next attempt.
Yep.
And that's very different. And so, you know, that's the part that I think really elevates this above a lot of other climbing achievements, you know, because you have to prepare for such a different goal in a way. You know, if Lynn Hill's like, oh, I'm going to go out and free this, or, you know, some hard sport climber is going to try, you know, sport climb is the perfect venue for this discussion because people will go out and they'll hang the draws on the route and they'll say, okay, I get four or five really good burns in or whatever it is today. And if I don't get it, then I'll try tomorrow and I'll project this route for 6 years if I have to.
Yep.
But if you were to go back to Adam Ondra or Chris Sharma and say, hey, you know, that 15C you guys put up, how long would it take for you guys to get ready to do that route so that you knew you could, like, you say go and you're not allowed to fall or you die, right?
Yep.
Like, they would never leave the ground.
Yep.
And so, you know, so that's, I think that's sort of where the comparison really starts to break down.
Yep. man, I want to, we need to use your expression. You love this expression, put a pin in it. I want to get back to that when we start later move and talk about like the future of climbing and like what's next in terms of the big accomplishments, because I think we simply need to talk about that. It's going to get relevant again. But one other, because this was I'm only doing this one. This is a really, instead of apples to, you know, if Lynn Hill's pioneering is Lynn Hill, what we just talked about with freeing the nose is going to be a bit more apples to apples than this, but I'm actually interested precisely because of that. Like if we talk about, you know, an apples to oranges comparison of like, you know, this, Tommy Caldwell, with the Dawn Wall, which is a very high profile celebrated, I love this stuff, right? Like President Obama is like getting in touch to congratulate these climbers. I love that. On the one hand, climbing seems to be like pushed into this corner, and in a way is like, it seems kind of a lot of the time less visible than like high profile ski racers or, you know, and certainly when we're talking about the world of like, you know, basketball, football, et cetera, and yet like the Dawn Wall gets sent and the president is offering congratulations. Like the world comes out.
Right.
And pays attention to climbing. It's interesting to me and sort of why that is the case.
Well, I think that's a really good point. And I think climbing is a really strange thing for a lot of reasons, but that's one of them, right? On the one hand, you're right. Climbers very much exist in, you know, on the shadowy fringes sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And in part because climbers are, even with this like last 5 years sort of explosion in climbing is still, you know, what you would call a fringe sport relative to something like basketball or soccer or whatever. But, you know, I guess I should add that I think that part of that is that climbing comes from this very, what's the adjective for this? Maybe irreverent past, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's sort of this like, rebel, the whole like lionization of the dirt bag and blah, 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 blah. It's very anti-establishment in a way that a lot of other sports traditionally don't have that cultural thread running through them.
True.
And so it's not like they're entirely victimized by being on the sidelines here. You know, I think a lot of climbers would probably prefer it that way. At the same time, you know, you do have these cultures where people on the day-to-day granular level, like don't give a shit about climbing at all. But climbing also has this incredibly visceral pull for obviously climbers, but even for the average person. I mean, what a huge deal was it when Edmund Hillary climbed Mount Everest, right? I mean, that was like massive historical event. I mean, you know, talk about the world coming together for those things. Like that's obviously gets done very routinely now, but you know, the Dawn Wall certainly is interesting in that you're like, oh my God, people are caring about rock climbing, but you know, there has been this like this tradition of using climbing or, you know, shining a light on climbing as like an inspirational thing, I guess, in broader society.
Yeah.
You know, climbing is a good stand-in or metaphor for all kinds of things related to like adventure or, you know, freedom of spirit and blah, 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 blah. However that stuff is deployed, I guess, in the larger culture. But, yeah, you know, for whatever reason, we have this like weird, I think you're right. We have this culture where we at the same moment, we like really deeply care and then we don't care like at all, you know? It's almost like, you know, people obviously cared a profound amount when we landed on the moon, but like, do we give a shit about NASA? Well, you could also look around and make the case that we don't, you know?
Yep.
And so it kind of feels like somewhat dichotomous in that way.
So can you say, I mean, maybe just something, is there anything interesting to be said in terms of the accomplishment of freeing the Dawn Wall versus what we've just seen here in terms of, you know, because we're sitting here kind of gushing and I anything interesting to say on that? Or are you like, dude, that one's just a little too different. Let's move on.
No, it's not a little too different. I think that there is a point to be made there though, that climbing has really reached a stage in its evolution where it is harder and harder to make some of those cross-discipline comparisons because as the sport has grown and these things have migrated further and further away from each other, it just becomes, you know, you start to see this like divergent evolution going on where you're like boulders and trad climbers increasingly have less to talk about. You know, they come from more and more different worlds. And so, you know, how do you compare the achievement of like setting the world's hardest boulder problem versus something like sending the Dawn Wall? Man, I mean, that's, you know, certainly you could probably go on and break down all the individual things, but you know, that's really, that gets hard to do, especially as, you know, as you have the conversation with a non-climbing audience. And part of what makes the Dawn Wall so hard to send, on top of that whole Lynn Hill believing this is possible type of thing, there's, you know, dozens of pitches, right? And you have to remember, well, what do you need for each pitch? What are the moves on that pitch? It's not just like work, you know, you try one pitch endlessly until you can climb it in your sleep sort of thing. I mean, you just can't do that with 3,000 feet of rock climbing. So, you know, how do you manage the knowledge that goes into a project like that? And so,
they're on the wall for 19 days.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's like when I go on a trip for 4 days, it's like, crap, I forgot to, you know, pack enough clothes or, let alone 19 days hanging off the, you know, thousands of feet off the ground.
Freaking portal edge. I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, and that's really it, right? Is I think it. So did you see at all how Adam Andre came to the valley and repeated the Dawn Wall?
I was just say more.
So Adam Andre came to the valley and, you know, sponged all of Tommy Caldwell's beta and basically like did the second ascent of the Dawn Wall in like no time. I mean, it took Tommy Caldwell years to do this route, right? Yeah. And it took Adam Andre like a week to repeat it. And the difference there is not that Adam Andre is an infinitely better climber than Tommy Caldwell, who's just like some has-been punter at this point. You know, he's certainly not the young gun cutting edge climber anymore. But at the same time, the difference is that Adam Andre came to a route that he knew could be climbed, and he knew what the grade was of the route, knew all the grade pitch down. Tommy gave him all the beta. But it's all of the logistics. You know, this is the gear you need for this pitch. This is where you're going to go. These are all the tricks that it took me 7 years to figure out. Mm-hmm. And when you're armed with all of that stuff, particularly the knowledge that it is achievable, then you can just set yourself to throwing yourself at it blindly as hard as you can.
Yep.
You know, and that's where the person like Adam Andre, who is this sort of like almost genetic abnormality in some ways, you know, he's good at taking, like, just holding on to things that other people can't hold on to, right? That's kind of what it boils down to.
Yeah.
And so his contribution is really just this physical prowess. It's not, you know, digesting this massively complex logistical problem.
Yeah, yeah. Related to what we've been talking about, so keep this short, but what would you consider to be then the greatest accomplishment in sport climbing? Like, at that point, is the answer simply like whatever the new agreed upon hardest grade in the world is? I mean, is that
do feel that way.
Yeah.
And you know, you're probably getting hate mail like already for me saying that.
Yeah.
But you know, and I guess I do have a little bit of a bias as kind of like a somebody who prefers like trad and alpine climbing a little bit.
Yeah.
But I essentially do think that is the case, right? Because, you know, sport climbing came onto the scene relatively late, you know, in America anyway, and the whole, you know, at the time there's this big pushback because everybody else more traditionally thought that that was like the use of bolts in general, but the whole like project style of climbing was very anathema to the culture at the time, and it was really like pretty roundly rejected.
Yeah.
And eventually became sort of its own discipline and was accepted by the larger community, and, you know, they certainly have history on their side, the sport climbers, but the whole concept, right, is to take away everything that is either logistically complicated or dangerous about climbing and just focus on the movement. You know, how hard can you climb? Move for move,
yep.
Route for route, one pitch at a time, that kind of thing. I mean, it's trying, the effort, the goal is like try to take the experience and distill it down to the athleticism component.
Yep.
And so if you look at it that way, I do think it's fair to say that, yes, the most impressive sport climb is the hardest one out there, because, yep. You know, you have been sort of intentionally built this arena to, yep, just be about the athleticism. And I guess you could make the case that, like, you have to take into account the climber, right? Because climbs are different for different climbers with things like reach and, you know, and body morphology and like all that kind of thing, right? Yep. So maybe like this 5'2 climber climbing this 14 whatever route is impressive, more impressive than like, you know, some other taller climber, whatever.
Yep.
And I guess you could kind of debate about that, but, you know, that's nitpicking, and it's not fundamentally changing the fact that you're just comparing athleticism to athleticism.
Right.
And so, yeah, I do think that sport climbing is, it's much easier to talk about in that way.
Yeah. And so, I mean, are we then, I presume then it's kind of a similar answer. I'm just trying to think of like what in my lifetime, what I've, you know, like, oh my God, you know, this sport climbing feat just happened.
Right.
And I don't know that it's met. I mean, maybe for precisely.
I think a lot of climbers, people who follow the climbing scene closely, might have felt that way when Chris Sharma sent, yeah, Realization,
well,
in
that's
like 2001, 2000.
Yeah, that's the one I had in mind.
Yeah,
but like,
you know, that because it's really difficult with sport climbing to break a fundamental barrier. Right.
Yeah.
People were kind of like, is there going to be a 15A? Will the world get there? Where is it going to be? You know, and then people were kind of clamoring for it and ready for that barrier to be broken. And we were kind of like anxious, like actively waiting for the next person to come along and climb that stuff.
Yeah.
And now, you know, with the explosion of the sport, it feels like there's just kids coming out climbing harder and harder stuff every other week. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it feels almost like at this point, the harder and harder sport routes, 515B, five, this other whatever, I mean, if they feel like sequels to an original, like, great movie.
Yeah.
A little bit.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
Well done.
Thank you.
And then in the bouldering world, I mean, obviously, I think it's we can just say similar, you know, similar to what we've just been, everything we've just talked about with respect to sport climbing, it kind of is in play. But I can't think of the you know, shot heard round the world, in bouldering.
Sure.
In quite, and I do think, I mean, I'm sure I am forgetting massive accomplishments, but Sharma's Realization is the sport route that, to me, that's kind of the one that if we were thinking about it in those terms, like the shot heard round the world, that feels kind of like, if not the answer,
yeah,
to the question,
sure,
it's,
well, you know, we talk about talk about you not really being aware of the bouldering shot heard around the world or whatever.
Yeah.
To that point, there's a pro Finnish climber called Nale. I'm not even going to try to butcher his last name.
Yeah.
But, you know, super, super strong boulderer, obviously, total crusher, sent this long time project of his like last fall in October. And he claimed V17 as the grade, making it the only V17 in the world after like many years of all the world's strongest climbers, you know, kind of languishing at V16.
Yeah.
And you hadn't heard about that, right? And that's basically, nope, all you need to say about this.
Yep.
And so like that is as, I would say that is as big as accomplishments get in the bouldering world.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about like highball bouldering, but then you're essentially just kind of like, you're not really pushing, you're not advancing bouldering at its essence for notoriety, you're sort of just tiptoeing into free soloing. For
exactly.
Notoriety.
Exactly. You know? And I mean, you know, spoiler alert, that's where I'm headed with the question about what's next in climbing is I think that's what's next in climbing is that what we're calling highballing, which is really now just sport climbing without ropes.
Right. Absolutely.
And that's anyway, so
tons of gray area there without a doubt.
Yeah. So let's make that the next, you know, kind of moving on. So to that question of like, what in the hell is next in climbing? Like, what is the new frontier? That is what it seems like to me, is that we're just free soloing really hard sport routes now.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I see your point. And I think it gets at something really interesting, because if you want to talk about the landmark nature of Alex Honnold's free solo, so the crux of that route, right, we already talked about, is the Boulder problem. It's this like V7 short crux, two-thirds of the way up the route, right? I mean, highball boulder problems have been sent at a much harder grade than V7 for a long time, right?
Yep.
And the consequence to those problems may not be like guaranteed ultra dramatic death,
right,
but it's certainly like many broken bones, high possibility of death.
Yep.
And so to some extent, you would be not, you know, totally unfair to say, well, so what, free rider, right? You know, a lot of secure crack climbing, V7 highball, you know, off you go to the top sort of thing. And you know, that's fair, right? I think that's, that does get at what do we consider to be impressive or boundary pushing, maybe better.
Yeah.
You know, people have been climbing dangerous high boulder problems out in the buttermilks in California for freaking ever. I mean, you know, there's a V11 called Ambrosia that Kevin Jorgensen put up a while ago that's had a whole bunch of ascents, including Alex Honnold. This female climber named Nina Williams just did a repeat of it. It's not exactly fair. I guess the crux is like down low, and then there's like, you know, 40 feet of 12C climbing to the top. But, you know, you're still talking about 12C climbing possibility of death if you blow it.
Yeah. So the whole route, this, what's the name of it? The V11?
It's called Ambrosia. It's on Ambrosia, the far side of the famous boulder called the Grandpa Peabody Boulder.
So, yeah. And the entire height of the problem is about 50 feet or the
you're saying?
Okay.
I think so.
Dear Lord, I don't want to fall 50 feet without a rope.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, you know, at some point you have to transport yourself beyond the number of feet you are above the air and say, well, you know, I am going to die if I fall. So a 50-foot Ambrosia is a 50-foot V11, which is 514. You know, that would translate into a 514 if you bolted that. And yes, I think the way to mentally break that down is to say, well, the V11 is relatively low on the route.
Yeah.
And then it's 12C to the top, which is more like V4, V5. But even so, right, you are in the you will die zone.
Yeah.
And that, I think, gets at the heart of our national fascination with Alex Honnold, is because that what makes him special is that he's just not quite scared of the things that we are collectively scared of, which is to say exposure, right? It's not necessarily like hard moves above the ground. It's hard moves above the ground times exposure sort of thing.
Yep.
And, you know, that's why these 50-foot V11s have a bunch of repeats, and we may go however long until somebody else, you know, at least another, I'd say the next generation, until somebody else does free rider again. Right. Because, you know, you're climbing 12C 30 feet off the ground. It's just harder to win the psychological game, rational or otherwise, than if you're like 2,000 feet off the ground.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you ask some normal person off the street to stand on a sidewalk and that's fine, but you ask them to like tiptoe to the edge of a building and they're like, fuck no.
Yep.
And that's really what it is, right? It's the psychological distinction.
Yeah. We go back to that initial text that you sent me, you know, on Saturday, and you're like mind fully blown.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, that's precisely why we're talking about this. Like, we're searching for like, how do we locate and contextualize what just happened? And I think this is such a striking achievement that, you know, so let's do that thing and get, if we weren't if we weren't fully apples to apples before in comparison, like now let's go completely like apples to zebras to guitars, you know, and just talk about like, where would we kind of think about this and locate this in terms of other athletic accomplishments? And, you know, which points to the really big question, why isn't this the greatest athletic accomplishment ever? What else has happened in, say, the modern broad sporting era, or any time where it's like clearly event X would be put ahead of this?
Right.
And so, you know, I started thinking about that. I mean, in terms of all kinds of other, you know, in terms of, you know, achievements we've seen on a basketball court or on a baseball diamond or on a soccer field or on a, you know, in a ski race. And it's funny, like, as I, you know, I had a 5-hour drive yesterday to be thinking about some of this, and it starts to get hard where it's like, well, obviously, like when the Red Sox came back and beat the Yankees,
right? That, or the Patriots winning a Super Bowl.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, what, you know, or maybe we just have incredibly limited imaginations, but what for you, for you would tend to be up there to rival what just happened?
I think that's, I mean, that's such a good question, and it's really hard to answer because this is such a, the achievement, because of the mental dimension to it, you know, in light of the penalties involved, make it so hard to compare to something that's raw athleticism with no real penalty. But, you know, I think if you, the best way to try to approach that comparison is like, what else out there not only was like, oh my God, that was wild, you know, that backhand or that shot or whatever, but like, it has to be more than that. Like, it has to change people's it has to initiate a paradigm shift in people's minds. You know, even people who are well-versed in the sport, right? Can't just be like outsiders watching and being like, oh my God, I can't believe they just caught that pass or whatever.
Right.
And I don't know. I mean, I honestly think that, you know, the probably the most easily standout moment would be Roger Bannister breaking the 4-minute mile. That's, you know, that's like one of those things that's talked about even still as being one of the greatest athletic achievements of all time. And not because we can't rival it anymore or the record, not one of those like records that still stands kind of thing, but it's like, well, that was so ridiculous for its era, but even more so like answered this question definitively of like, can this or can this not ever be done? And that's, I think if you're going to try to pick a moment to stand up to this free soul, you need to have that element.
That's impossible element.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. Or at least like, I think probably Alex obviously knew this was possible. I think everybody who's around him who helps him with this and a lot of pro climbers probably have the idea that this is possible or that this will happen at some point or whatever. But it's more like the, you have to be able to make the good case that it's not possible or that maybe not that it isn't possible, but that it won't be done.
Yeah.
Which is probably more apt in this case, just because it's more reasonable to believe that no one's ever going to try because it's so dangerous rather than like, you know, I'm sure there's hundreds of people out there who are physically possible, like capable of doing this. But it's reasonable to believe that this would go undone because nobody attempted it, which is so different than so many other of those sports records that are just never going to fall. Half of them are, you know, carved in stone now because the rules of the sport have changed. Like the sport has changed around the rules. Anyway.
I mean, I do like one for me that, and now like, I don't know, people listening to this podcast might not care at all, but like, whatever, outdoor people should like basketball more than they do. So here you go.
I mean, like, I think everybody should look back like basketball more than they do.
Exactly. Stephen Curry shooting a basketball. Like, Steph Curry shoots a basketball at an impossible level.
Right.
Right? Like, like literally, in the history of the league, nobody has ever shot a basketball like this. Mm-hmm. And I think this has defied what we thought was possible in terms of accuracy and percentages and efficiency from shooting from so far away.
Yeah, I mean, and he's reimagined the sport at a strategic level, right? Like, you can plan differently around that kind of skill.
Like, we've had, like, you know, Larry Bird, we go back to the 80s. Larry, when the shot clock was running down and he had to force a shot up, was absolutely capable of hitting a shot as deep as Steph Curry.
Right.
But Steph Curry, literally in game two of the finals the other night, pulled up from the hash mark when time was not running down. It was just a play in the middle of a game.
Right.
That didn't ever used to happen. And if you tried that, by the way, at like, I mean, my high school coach would have like pulled me out of the game so quickly, you know. And so I think, like, I do think that Steph Curry is doing something at an unprecedented slash kind of impossible level. But he, if he misses, he doesn't die.
Right. And that's, you know, that's this, I think, is important to the conversation, because Alex Honnold is not climbing anywhere near his limit when he's doing this.
Yeah.
Steph Curry is trying to play basketball right at his limit.
Yeah.
And so part of the reason these comparisons are difficult is because you're comparing the feats of somebody who is, you know, there's, on the one hand, all these most sports events that we're familiar with have, are just this raw athleticism, like man be man kind of thing.
Yeah.
And this is not right. He's not particularly trying that hard.
Yeah.
It's impressive that he doesn't have to try that hard on this route. The impressiveness is that this is so easy for him that, you know, I don't even know what the right, like what the, you know, mainstream sports analogy would be. Right. But if it's like Steph Curry, just like launching shots from the half court mark with nobody else on the court,
yeah,
you know, and just like hitting them.
Yeah. I mean, this is where, and like, to kind of move through this a little bit quicker, I think sometimes when we are thinking about like, what is the greatest athletic achievement ever?
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes we, when we, I mean, when we think about it in sort of team sport environments, you know, you might think like, well, what about when, you know, Curt Schilling and the Red Sox, you know, came back from what, down, was it 3-0 or 3-1 to beat the Yankees?
Yeah.
Or frankly, LeBron James last year beating the Warriors when everyone was like, this is, they had the winningest record in the history of the NBA. People were like, this might be the best team to ever play in the NBA. And then LeBron James comes back and beats them. I mean, I think that's like a contender.
Absolutely.
But I do think, like, to me, the, and so that starts getting into the realm of like upsets. And that is, that's not relevant here. So I think,
well, you need two to tango to have an upset. You know what I'm
saying?
Like the other team has to collapse.
Yep. And so like the miracle on ice in hockey, right? Like US beats Russia, like unbeatable Russian team, that kind of stuff. I feel like, okay, we got to cross all those off because the upset narrative doesn't work here.
Absolutely.
But then, so honestly, the thing that I keep wondering about, and Dave, I don't even know, we've never talked about it. Like, have you watched this Red Bull Rampage mountain bike event?
No.
Dude, I honestly kind of think this is about as close as I can get to thinking, like, go just pull up any YouTube video of Red Bull Rampage and watch for 90 seconds and you'll know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
But you have dudes riding bikes on effectively unrideable terrain in like the desert of Utah. And then each year they just keep upping the ante and like adding these 80-foot gap jumps over canyons where like you come up short, it's not guaranteed you're dead, but you're breaking a lot of bones and the chance of like paralysis is like, just, I mean, again, just watch and then picture like riding a bike off the, you know, the ledge. Honestly, I think the degree of difficulty coupled with the high, the consequential nature of that event is honestly about the best thing I can find. And which is to say, I guess the people that are sending and winning events like Red Bull Rampage, I'm also tempted to put up in the conversation of like, show me a more impressive athletic achievement.
Sure.
And for my own thinking about this and whatever, it may be irrelevant. Like, I tend to kind of downplay events like, I mean, all due respect, but when you talk about Roger Bannister's breaking of the 4-minute barrier, that was one of those like, you just made the impossible possible. But it's a kind of one-dimensional element. And
very
so
one-dimensional.
And so I think of like, you think of an extreme sport like deep water diving. where mm-hmm. the goal is like who can literally get the furthest depth before their lungs explode.
Right.
Like that's crazy and the stakes are real high, but that I'm still from a novice here. I know that there is a lot of calculation that goes into that, those events, right? That, but it still feels a little bit more one dimensional there.
Well, that has the like the physical capability to do it component, yeah. and it's got the high consequence component, but it doesn't. And yeah, I mean, similarly, unwell versed person here, but like it doesn't have the high degree of technical performance involved, right? Like, don't the people who free dive like just don't they like launch down a rope with a weight on their feet, kind of thing, like see how deep they can go and that kind of thing?
Yeah.
I mean, you're not executing these like ultra precise, highly technical movements.
Yeah.
And that's what makes this thing so interesting. And I think actually, I just thought of something while you were talking about the mountain bike thing. The interesting thing about free soloing and Alex Honnold as the sort of pinnacle free soloist is that it's not, you watch these videos of the people talking about it, and they are all pretty firmly pushed back against the idea that this is like a high octane adrenalized experience for them. Because the whole concept is to be profoundly in control and so confident in your control that why would your heart rate go up, right? Mm-hmm. If you're starting to freak out, then, you know, you've done something wrong. You've either chosen the wrong route or you didn't prepare or you're off, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, it doesn't have, like with the mountain bike thing, staying on those courses is like snap decision. You know, you're moving and thinking extremely quickly. And this is precision, but much more slowed down, right?
Yeah.
Like, I was reading recently, this article is from, 2015, but it's sort of relevant. And, it's a New York Times article where at some point later in the article, they interview, Dean Potter and, you know, obviously like the other obvious free soloist to talk about in this conversation. And prior to his death, I think a lot of people had been wondering, oh, is Dean going to go in free solo free rider someday? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just to provide some insight into what separates Alex from like all the other free soloists, there's a quote in here that I have up, and it goes that this is Dean Potter talking. He says, Alex is like Spock. I freak out at the top of solos and scream, like super emotional. Then I'm wasted emotionally for months. Alex just does it and walks away and does another one. Hmm. And so, you know, even amongst the people who have the ability to command the like victory of the rational mind over the, you know, reptilian part of your brain that's freaking out that you're on a cliff. You know, obviously to some extent that's mandatory for anybody who wants to free solo anything, but he clearly is of a different stock relative to those people, right?
Yeah.
And that's like, that's the part of it that I don't see in a lot of these other sports like the mountain biking. You know, you would never like pluck somebody out, freeze time and pluck somebody out of those mind-blowing downhill runs and find them in like a state of zen, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they're in the zone. Like they're clearly in the zone, but it's not, like it's much more aggro.
Dude, when those guys get done riding, it is just relief. Like yeah, they exactly. all freak out and all yeah. the other riders come and like congratulate them. And it's freaking kind of morbid. It's like
yes,
their girlfriends exactly. are watching, by the way, and they're bawling.
Yes.
And I'm like, the guys come down and congratulate, and part of it is because they just did rowdy, rad stuff.
Yeah.
But the other part is like, dude, you're alive and not broken in half, and hell yeah. And we know what that's like because we're up there scared too.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of free soloists kind of bristle at the notion that they're considered adrenaline seekers.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, I guess, a little bit different. You know, not to take anything away from any of those mountain bike achievements at all, right? But it doesn't have quite the same texture to it.
Yeah. Interesting.
But that's what I think, maybe to, you know, kind of bring this all back, that's part of what makes this Alex Honnold thing so, I mean, we're kind of like moths to a flame with it, right? Because we just can't understand how you could occupy that mental space while you're doing something like this. Mm-hmm. Like, you tell me that these mountain bike guys are like all jacked up and doing this stuff and they're in the zone and they're riding these super dangerous rides and so forth and pulling it off. I'm like, yeah, I can totally imagine feeling that way, right? The hardest mental leap from me to them for me to make is imagining myself with like a lot more biking skill, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, I can't just imagine myself as a stronger climber and be like, yeah, I can picture that. Mm-hmm. I can't even really sort of fully turn the corner to see what that's like.
And that's the
most alluring part.
Yeah. And I mean, you were talking about, you know, I mean, I had seen, you know, Tommy Caldwell, who has been a big part of this, right? Of Alex's prep. You just said, I mean, he and Alex the previous week, right, had free climbed, right. Free right. rider. And, you know, Tommy Caldwell in his, I think it was on an Instagram post, was just like, I'm just freaking glad this is over.
He actually left the Valley so that he wouldn't have to watch it. And that says a lot.
Yeah,
for sure. I can totally appreciate, and this is probably the same with, you know, all these other extreme athletes. You probably get to a point where it's harder to be a spectator than the athlete.
Yeah.
At least in terms of emotion.
Yeah.
And so I fully believe that. But
you were saying too, right, that Tommy's climbing partner on the Don Wall. You said before.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Kevin
Jorgensen.
Yeah.
Kevin Jorgensen commented on Jimmy Chin's photo of Alex climbing the Enduro Corner pitches, which is a two-pitch stretch high up on the route. It just looks horrifically hard and so exposed. And he commented that the photo, looking at the photo, was making him nauseous.
Yeah,
and this is somebody who sent the Don Wall, right?
Sent the Don Wall, yeah.
Yeah.
slept yeah. up on the wall for yes. 19 days.
Totally. This is not your grandmother commenting, being like, oh my God.
Yeah. No, yeah. You have to say it, one of the most accomplished big yes. wall climbers.
Actually, not accomplished, like certainly wall climber, but he's actually the guy who has the FA of that boulder problem, Ambrosia, right?
Huh.
So obviously not a... you know, stranger to like dangerous climbing,
right?
You know, like the guy clearly gets free solo climbing. I mean, he put up that V11 boulder problem,
yeah,
and has done tons of run out climbing on boulders all over the place,
yeah.
And even he looks at this and is like, that is disgusting.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Oh, it is. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, we'll wrap up here, but I think Alex is just such an interesting person, far beyond. I mean, that dude could stop climbing tomorrow entirely, and I still think that's a really interesting person. And, you know, and I do want to be careful. Like, before we make the move, I mean, Dean Potter's quote, I think, is super interesting. Like, that dude's just Spock.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like there is some... I mean, this is one of those questions, right? Like, when we see kind of the impossible get done, when we just simply say, well, that person is other, that mm-hmm. that's just like, that's alien. And right. I think that's an interesting thing to do. And I actually want to be cautious before we do that, because in a way then that just writes off. I mean, if it's like, yeah, he's missing a chromosome, so right. he actually can't tell the difference when he's 1,000 feet off the ground versus 0 feet off the ground. In a right. way, then, it sort of almost diminishes the accomplishment.
Sure.
I think what Alex has talked about is he has just trained himself. And he has spoken incredibly eloquently about this. Yes. I mean, that's another thing I find remarkable about Alex. Like, that dude talks as eloquently and succinctly about some of these accomplishments in ways that most modern athletes are terrible at.
I know, totally. I mean, this would be such a bummer if he just gave like terrible interviews that had like no thought into it.
Where he's like, I don't know, man. Yeah. I just was kind of feeling it today. And like, I was like, you know, thinking about my homies and I was like stoked, bro.
I'm trying to go out there and like score a bunch of points and execute on the plays we practiced.
And, yeah. And I mean, it's probably goes hand in hand. Like, he is so analytical and clear in his answers. And I'll say it again. We'll post the link to this interview that he gives shortly after sending Free Rider, and just look at what I'm talking about here, and look at from any past interview he's given when he's been, you know, asked these questions about fear and overcoming it and what he's thinking about. I think it's another remarkable thing about this guy, that he's not only pulling off these incredible athletic achievements, but then turning around and talking about them as eloquently as maybe any athlete ever really has.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's, it's such an interesting conversation, I think, with these things where you, people, I think most climbers will have some kind of concept, or can at least walk themselves towards the idea of free soloing by way of analogy, where, you know, I think that climbing is not, it's easy to explain climbing to non-climbers using driving a car as an analogy,
yeah.
Where driving a car is profoundly dangerous. And you can make a irrecoverable fatal mistake in less than a second.
Yeah.
Going 70 miles an hour, which would kill you and several other people. No problem. That's very easy to do. And we do that stuff every single day, right? And the reason that your fear level is not commensurate with that level of danger is because you're sort of in control. I mean, driving is not that hard. And you're like, well, I'm just not going to do that. You know, like, I'm just not going to drive off the road. And that's how free soloists think about free soloing, right?
Yep.
And that, you know, it becomes this awkward conversation where two people are, you know, there's Alex Honnold on one side and then an interviewer or non-climber on the other. And they're kind of talking past each other,
yep,
a little bit, where the climbers, the interviewer is like, well, you know, aren't you scared that you're going to fall? And he's like, well, no, because I'm not going to fall.
Right.
And that's like end of conversation, right? There's nothing else really to be said there. And then, you know, I think you either can get past that mentality or not. You know, that's just a matter of like which part of your brain is driving. You know, is it this utter domination of the rational over, you know, the rest of your brain, where you're like, well, it would be horrible if I slipped here, but since there's a 0% chance of me slipping, there's no sense in being afraid of it, you know?
Yeah.
In the same way that, like, if you ask any other person, like, hey, are you just gripped and sweating and white knuckling it like every time you drive your car? Like, of course not. You know, and you know, it's like this with these people. You know, would you drive your car 140 miles an hour? Of course not. No, because you could lose control. And it's the same thing with like, would you free solo close to your limit? No, you know, but you know, you drive it in conditions that you understand and, you know, in ways that you feel like you have it, but the danger is there, you know, in the same way that these people are asking Alex, like, yeah, but
the only counter though, and then we'll wrap, but the only counter here is that if you polled 100 of us, I mean, going back to the driving analogy, if you polled 100 of us who, you know, drive a decent amount, are, you know, why aren't you terrified driving down a highway for 5 hours going 80 miles an hour? It's like, well, I don't know. I do it a lot, you know, feel real comfortable in that environment. The only thing is what you already talked about is that elite climbers,
yes,
are weighing in and looking at this and going like, oh, hell no.
Totally. And I mean, that's what makes this such an enormous accomplishment. It's more like,
so I don't even know. I don't
know what
I'm
saying. Like it puts it on a spectrum, right? It becomes, when you think about it that way, it's a matter of degree.
Yeah. So it's almost, I mean, I don't know what the analogy is, cause I like the driving one, but it's like, would it be like, okay, yeah, I'm pretty comfortable. I just did it yesterday. Drove 80 miles an hour for 5 hours on a highway next to big trucks. Mm-hmm. I didn't do it with my eyes closed.
Right. Yeah, totally. And I mean, I think it's not that like any people can aspire to that sort of accomplishment. It's just that I think that people make a mistake when they see things like this and they think like they can't even understand how the calculation might look in Alex's mind. Like I would never do something like that. And I would push back and say, you actually do that all the time.
All the time, yeah.
It's just that you are comfortable in these other environments and you choose to have a much larger buffer of safety and all that stuff. But the calculation itself is very familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, man, cool. I feel like we should wrap, but
okay.
I just think this is one of those accomplishments that deserves, you know, some people stammering around as best they can to try to...
Yes.
In a way, this feels like this is the respect part. It is such a compelling accomplishment that the very, very least we can do is sit there and try to think through it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a whole lot there's a lot of uncomfortable stuff to unpack here that we could probably save for another conversation.
Yeah.
Like, how do you feel if you're his sponsors? Or how do you feel as a consumer of the inevitable movie that's going to come out of this? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you feel comfortable being contributing to that culture? And additionally, like, how different would this conversation have been had he blown it, right?
Yep.
Because that's sort of what happened to Uli Steck pretty recently, right? Like, he kind of came out on the wrong side of something similar. And again, you know, not to try to get into the apples and oranges of their climbing styles, but yeah, you know, you're in a situation unprotected that you seem like you have control over and that you think you have control over, but you don't. And then, well, you know, one person's like a generation defining hero and the other's like kind of an idiot and was a little careless. Like, well, that's a little bit harsh.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like because there's a slight luck factor that pushes you from one side of that line or the other, it's like you're either one of the greatest people in the world or you're an asshole. Right. This is a very easy way to shine a pretty uncomfortable light on, like, back on us a little bit.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point.
Anyway, well, we could save that for another talk.
Well, Dave, I don't know why it took so long. You and I have been friends for a very, very long time, and it's so fun. It's always fun talk. I mean, it's fun. We have a great time talking about, I think, everything.
Totally.
including the Brothers Karamazov, which made it into this podcast. I will see if I end up keeping it in or not.
I should have asked you this when we got started, but I was under the assumption that all that could get cut pretty easily.
We'll see how it plays. But this was fun, and we will definitely get you back on talking about more climbing
cool.
things. But this was a hell of an excuse to have this conversation.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, I'm grateful for the opportunity. It was awesome to debut myself on this podcast.
Well, cool, man. Well, great. We'll have fun. I'm gonna probably be seeing you like in a couple days, which we'll get off the air, and I'll tell you about that in a minute.
Okay.
But
cool. Yeah, well, man, just bring my check for the appearance in person.
Okay, and I got to pick up my shoes that I left at your place last time. So well, hey, man, cool. And I'll talk to you real soon.
All right, sounds good, dude. I'll see you later.
All right, bye-bye. That's it for this edition of the Blister Podcast. Thanks to Dave Alley for the conversation, and to Alex Honnold for blowing our minds and expanding the limits of what is possible. And thanks also to our strikingly handsome audio engineer, Justin Bob, who I'd like to wish a very, very happy birthday to. I've got a birthday present for you, J-Bob, and I look forward to celebrating with you later today. We've already got another really great podcast episode in the bag that I'm really excited about, so stay tuned for that. And till that time, check us out at blisterreview.com to see what we're up to on the site. Talk to you soon.